I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. A new estimate from the Centers for Disease Control suggests that the rates of autism in the United States are on the rise. The center found that 1 in 88 children have the diagnosis of autism or an autism-related disorder. For boys, it's 1 in 54. This is a dramatic increase in the last 10 to 20 years. Does this spike mean that more children are developing the condition, or that there's better screening and diagnosis, or something else? Today on Radio Times, we want to make sense of these findings and their implications, and we have three guests who have joined us, two of whom are with us in our Philadelphia studio. Craig Neuschafer is a professor and chairman of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at Drexel University, just named the director of the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute, and that's the nation's first autism center focused on public health science. And Craig Neuschafer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
A pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Amy Golden. She's a board-certified behavioral analyst and the parent services coordinator at Autism New Jersey. Amy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. And on the telephone is M. Michelle Rowe, and she's the executive director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support and professor of health services at St. Joseph's University. And Michelle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here as well. Thank you.
Craig, let me begin with you and actually begin with a definition, because I want to make sure that we all know what we're talking about here. What is the current definition or even diagnosis of autism? What does that include? What are we talking about?
Well, so autism is defined behaviorally. So it's a diagnosis based on observed behavioral impairments. And impairments have to be present in three domains. They have to be present in the area of social interaction, communication, and also the third area is an area of specialized interests or repetitive behaviors. Onset has to be early in life. There are currently three diagnostic categories that fall under the autism spectrum, right? Autistic disorder, Asperger's, and PDD-NOS.
And what does PPD-NOS mean?
Yeah, alphabet soup. It stands for Pervasive Developmental Disorders Not Otherwise Specified.
Oh, interesting. So we're talking about a spectrum with obviously a variation in these behaviors that you just described.
Absolutely. There's variation in severity across all three of those domains, and then across other dimensions that aren't even fundamental to the diagnosis, such as cognitive impairment and different functional domains as well.
Well, going back to then this CDC estimate, as it's called, what do you make of the fact that something like 1 in 88 children in the U.S. has autism or one of these spectrum disorders? How do you understand these findings?
Well, the clear finding from this is that autism is a common, serious neurodevelopmental disorder in the United States, and one that demands increased attention. That's clear since the CDC began surveillance back in 2002. The issue of the ever-increasing trends is a little bit more complicated to understand.
Well, and I do want to get back to that. Michelle, let me get you in on this conversation. I'll also get Amy in as well. Michelle, how do you understand what the CDC concluded?
Well, there were a couple of studies that were done 2 years ago that began to look at some of these lower numbers or higher numbers in that regard. So the 1 in 54 was actually identified a while ago. And clinically, that seems to be what the schools are seeing as well. So part of it is a big surprise, part of it is not.
And the 1 in 54 is boys, yes?
Yes, it is.
And that's a number that's been around for a while?
About 2 years ago, some studies were done, and it took a while to sort of flush through what the results implied.
Why do you think boys are more diagnosed with autism?
That's a million-dollar question. There's some theories about it. They're beginning to look at testosterone, the role that that plays in this. There's a theory about boys and men being systematizers in a sense that the brain likes to organize and sort of fixate on details. There's also some indications about the chromosomally that boys have an X and a Y and girls have two X's, and maybe somehow the extra X with girls is protective, but they're all theories at this point.
Well, let me get you in on the conversation as well. Amy, as someone who's the parent services coordinator at Autism New Jersey, As a parent myself, reading this, it's a troublesome read. I'm curious about your response.
It certainly is troublesome to many families that are currently having children. They're considering red flags at a much earlier stage. Oftentimes, we find that with increased awareness, parents are calling us to ask more questions about their child and possible concerns. So we do feel that better awareness and better detection by doctors has played an influence in the prevalence numbers.
And Craig, going back to you, this does raise questions about what is causing these increased numbers. Do we know what causes autism?
No, we know that we know more than we knew probably 2 or 3 decades ago. We've known for quite some time that there is a strong genetic susceptibility component to autism. This was discovered back when the first twin studies were done in the late 1980s. Since then, there's been a major focus on genetic determinants of autism, and what's emerged from that essentially is that the genetic underpinnings of autism are extremely complex. Mm. And I think adding to that is an increased understanding that genetics probably don't operate by themselves in all cases, that there's probably an interplay between genetic and environmental factors that underlie a number of autism cases.
And let me go back to you, Michelle. Anything you want to add to that in terms of our understanding of what causes autism?
Well, there's probably some sort of inflammatory processes that go on in the body where the genetics are playing a role and the environmental insult or exposure triggers some autoimmune sort of thing, and again, that's a theory as well.
Right.
But that would be my perspective on this.
This sort of a combination of genetic factors and the environment.
Yes, at a critical period of time in development, so that it happens early on at some critical brain development time.
In utero.
In utero, I can't really be sure about what the answer to that would be, but it could be in utero in some cases. It could be after the child's been born. I think there's different types of autism that have been identified, and therefore there's probably different causes and different insults throughout different times in development.
Right. And you're nodding your head, Amy. You want to add to that?
I would agree with that. Autism is a very complex disorder, so there's likely to be more than one cause.
Does that make sense to you, Craig?
I agree that there's more than one cause. I do think that what we've come to know a little bit about the neuropathology of autism does strongly suggest that there are initiating events in utero. Certainly, the brain is a complex and plastic organ, and influences early in life or even later in life affect our behavioral profiles. But I do think that evidence is fairly strong that probably triggers are happening in the prenatal period.
Well, and just picking up on that, and this is not to scare anyone, but I was reading that children born to older parents are at potentially increased risk, that premature or low-weight babies are also at potential risk, and that exposure to certain drugs or even rubella in utero also increase the risk. And I don't want to go out on a limb here. That's why I'm looking at you, Craig.
No. Actually, if you want to talk about non-gene factors that we think are pretty conclusively linked with autism risk, the ones that you named are probably the comprised a small set of things that we're confident in. Associations between increased parental age. There's a little bit of a controversy about whether or not both increased mother's and father's age is associated with autism risk. The evidence is very clear with father's age, a little bit less clear with mother's age. That association,
so an older father?
Older fathers, yeah. That association has been replicated in a number of studies across in the United States and in Scandinavia. The increase is marginal with each decade, but it does appear to be real. There's compelling evidence showing that certain exposures, rubella is one, the drug thalidomide, which is no longer used in pregnancy, it's a known teratogen, it causes birth defects. That also, prenatal exposure back in the day was also linked to autism risk. So we do know there's proof of principle that things that operate in the prenatal period can cause autism. The last thing you mentioned was low birth weight.
Yes.
Those findings also have been replicated now. And low birth weight is associated with a range of developmental outcomes. So it's not surprising that it might increase the risk of autism to some extent.
Michelle, I'd be curious what you want to add to that.
Well, I would agree with everything that Craig said regarding that's what the latest research indicates.
I'm thinking that, we live in a world that's awash in chemicals. And to you, Michelle Rowe, Has there been research to look at the effect of some of these chemicals on a fetus in utero?
Well, there have been some studies that have suggested this inflammatory process in the brain, that there's been a genetic predisposition not toward autism but toward inflammatory processes, and that may have some sort of link relative to the environmental triggers. The question about what triggers they are, I think that's where we should be focusing our research, in looking at trying to systematically evaluate which of those variables would predict that someone would have autism.
Let me also go back to this CDC estimate, because they looked at 14 states. They found in Alabama it was 1 in 210. They found in Utah 1 in 47. Now, trying to understand this really dramatic difference in terms of regional difference or even state differences, and I guess, Craig, I'm back to you.
Yeah, it is striking, and I think as the CDC report indicates, there's a strong belief that much of this is due to differences in both the surveillance approach, the study approach, if you will, that is taken in the different regions. Some of the surveillance regions had access to both clinical records and education records, and some did not. And that's clearly associated with the rates. The more information that the surveillance has access to, the higher the rates. If you dig down a little bit deeper, you know, in past years, the CDC has also seen that once you get a hold of these records, all records aren't equal. And some records are much deeper and richer. There are more evaluations per child. And these things tend to vary from state to state, region to region, in accordance with the services that are available there.
So a little bit of apples and oranges when you look at some of these state findings. Amy, New Jersey kind of came high up on the list there. What's your understanding then in New Jersey?
Yeah, New Jersey was indicated to be the second highest in the nation. We do find that New Jersey educators and healthcare providers are excellent in their record keeping. And in New Jersey, there was an average of 8 records per child as compared to other states where there were only 3 available. So this rich documentation may have had an influence on the ability for the investigators to identify those affected by autism.
And I'm curious about your interest in autism.
My interest in autism started back in college. I worked with many families that had children involved in early intensive behavioral interventions.
And is that helpful, the idea of early intervention and perhaps even behavioral intervention in dealing with children on this spectrum?
Certainly. Behavioral intervention is the state-of-the-art intervention for children with autism. It often involves many, many hours, a lot of hard work, but we work to make sure that the treatment is motivating and effective for the child. It relies on applied behavior analysis, which is commonly known as ABA, and that's a treatment that is effective in teaching new skills and also reducing challenging behaviors.
So very behavior-directed in terms of dealing with these people with this diagnosis.
Yes.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about a new estimate from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention suggesting that rates of autism in the U.S. on the rise. They found that 1 in 88 children in the U.S. has autism or some autism-related disorder. The voice you just heard is Amy Golden, and she is board-certified behavioral analyst, the Parent Services Coordinator at Autism New Jersey. On the telephone, Michelle Rowe, and she's Executive Director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support, also Professor of Health Services at St. Joseph's University. And our third guest is Craig Neuschafer, and he is the Chairman of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at Drexel and the new Director of the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute. We'll be right back.
HYY. At Widener University, graduate courses are taught with real-life leadership experiences in a stimulating educational environment. In addition to their academic programs, Widener is committed to delivering the means for professional advancement and personal growth students seek in a graduate program, while accommodating work schedules through a variety of graduate degrees, including nursing, education, higher education, and more. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, win a 3-day intensive cooking workshop with PBS star chef Christina Perello. Visit Facebook.com/Newsworks and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. Like Newsworks on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of the rules, go to Newsworks.org, powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yefim Bruntman joins the Philadelphia Orchestra for Bartok's second piano concerto. Bruntman won a Grammy for his performance of this work. Also, Gilbert Varga conducts Stravinsky's Petrushka. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999. April 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Kimmel Center, Bruntman plays Bartok plus Petrushka with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the Centers for Disease Control report of last week, finding that autism and autism-related disorders are on the rise. Their estimate based on hospital and school records in 14 states found that 1 in 88 children have been diagnosed with a condition. We're talking about these findings and the research and treatment implications. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Craig, you wanted to add something to what Michelle was saying about inflammation, just in terms of our understanding of cause/effect.
Yeah, I just wanted to get back to that real briefly. I mean, the area of inflammatory processes is one area that's of active interest in people who think about autism causes, including myself. It's really complicated, though. There have been some somewhat surprising findings showing that there are markers of inflammation in the brains of individuals with autism. There's even been some genetic studies that have showed that genes overexpressed in the brains of individuals with autism include those related to the development of synapses, which are the way the neurons connect to each other in the brain, which is not surprising, but also those related to these inflammatory processes. But, and this is a big but, brain scientists will tell you that when something is dysregulated in the brain, you're often going to get signs of inflammation. So it's really hard to unpack whether or not inflammation could be part of a causal process or could be sort of a consequence of autism.
And this is part of what you and other researchers are, I guess, are looking at.
Yeah, we're very interested in it.
Trying to pinpoint. Michelle, if I could go back to you and Amy, I'd like to get your response as well. And again, as a total outsider, just, you know, learning about these latest findings, it did... Michelle, remind me a little bit of the diagnosis of learning disability that, of course, was very prevalent a couple of decades ago. And now we talk about learning differences. If we're talking about autism and autism-related disorders, is it also helpful to think about the broad sort of scope of this diagnosis and perhaps even the dangers of coming up with a disorder name for something that is just about differences between people?
Well, there's some theories that this is some sort of evolutionary change in the brain preparing us for whatever will come in the future. So it's interesting to see the sociological definition of these sorts of things. But, you know, there's a wide range. We can call autism a category, but there's just a huge range of behaviors and symptoms that go along with it. And as you've probably heard before, if you know one child with autism, you know one child with autism. That's about as far as it goes.
Right.
So whenever we're looking at these categories, we have to keep in mind that there's a lot of individual variability in this. Also, as we look at autism, you can think of it as sort of the infinite number line, where a child with autism can be along that line with a variation of difficult symptoms or easy symptoms. But there's a point at which that number line goes into the normal range. So we all have symptoms of autism. We all have symptoms of obsessive-compulsive disorder and those sorts of things. So, of course, it's the perception about what that is. Diagnosis means.
In fact, Amy, I've heard people say, but you know, we need people to program our computers. I mean, we need people to run the technology that we're so dependent on in this world.
Yes, I would agree with a lot of the statements that Michelle just made. And really, it's our belief that if an individual exhibits functional limitations that fall under the spectrum, that we need to provide that diagnosis and make sure that appropriate interventions are available for them.
Craig, you want to add to that?
No, just from the research perspective, I think that the increased recognition of autism as a spectrum will eventually be helpful to us in research as we come up with better ways to measure that dimensionality. Mm-hmm. You know, it makes it's more powerful to us when we do studies of cause, not only to be able to look at yes or no outcome, but be able to look at how certain factors might predict advancement along the spectrum. The measurement issues are challenging, but we've been getting better over the past past few years.
And when do some of the I guess symptoms of autism begin to express themselves, Craig?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. And I think that it's widely believed that using sort of the clinical tools that are available to us and the knowledge and acumen that folks like, you know, general pediatricians can acquire, that in many, many cases, autism can be recognized as early as age 2. Now, expert diagnosticians are trying to push the envelope, and there's lots of studies going on in laboratories around the country that are looking at trying to identify signs of autism as early as in babies as 6 months of age. Those aren't quite ready for prime time yet in terms of clinical practice, but clearly this is an exciting area of research, and as Amy will underscore, the earlier we can recognize the signs of autism, the earlier we can get kids into appropriate interventions and make a difference on their lives.
Yeah, what do you tell parents, Amy?
We feel strongly that early diagnosis will ultimately benefit the child. We feel that earlier diagnosis and appropriate intervention are truly vital. The research shows that the earlier diagnosis and involvement in early intensive interventions are going to improve the chances of the child making more significant progress. We do find progress in all individuals, so even if they do get a later start, we can make tremendous progress, but most of the more significant or dramatic improvements occur in younger children.
And Michelle, in specific, I mean, what should a parent look for?
Well, there's some early warning signs. The most significant ones are the social interaction that you would see with a young child. There's verbal aspects. No babbling or pointing or gestures by 12 months is always a red flag. Single words by 16 months. Two-word spontaneous phrases by 24 months, and a loss of language at any time should be immediately evaluated. So what that means is the child in a quality way interacting with those around him or her? So if you say, wow, look at the balloon going up in the sky, the child should be looking at the balloon and looking back at your face to say, oh, is this exciting? Oh, yes, it is exciting. There is the balloon. That's how children learn about social interaction. If you don't see that quality there, then certainly you should not wait on that.
And Michelle, I was also reading about eye contact, that's also an important indicator one way or the other?
Well, it is, but eye contact, not making eye contact alone, is not an indicator of autism necessarily. It's really the whole picture of how the child is interacting. There are kids that are just more shy, not necessarily going to stare you in the eyes, but if they have those other signs there where they are interacting, very connected, that's a different story. So you have to look at the whole package and not just eye contact.
You want to add to that, Craig? Then we'll get to our callers.
I was just going to say quickly that the CDC maintains an excellent website that has a compendium of resources around how to recognize the early signs of autism. You can find it at CDC's web, www.cdc.gov/act-early.
Okay, something to take a look at. And we're taking calls here at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking with Craig Neuschafer, Amy Golden, and Michelle Rowe about some of these findings from the Centers for Disease Control about rates of autism in the U.S., finding that 1 in 88 children have a diagnosis of autism or a related disorder. And again, 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Tim from Hillsboro to join us. And Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. Yeah, this is a very interesting panel, but I got to tell you, I am a parent of a 21-year-old adult autistic person, and I have lived this now for 21 years, and I have gone through the entire spectrum. My son is a classic case. He stopped talking at 14 months, started having problems. 2 months, took him to the doctor for his two-year checkup, rather, and the doctor said, oh, he's healthy as a horse. But then my wife said, well, he's not doing this, he's not doing this, he's not doing this. And at that point, I knew more about autism, you know, 18 years ago than this doctor did. And so now it's really changed. But it's funny, when I hear you guys talk about what the causes are, we don't know what the causes are. And the panel was saying, well, it could be this, could be the father's age, could be the mother's age, could be environmental, could be generic, could be this, could be that. I mean, no one seems to know, and we don't know. And that's the thing that bothers me, because I have a 24-year-old adult adult person, and I wonder, is his offspring going to be, you know, susceptible to having an autistic child? And that's what my concern is. No one's going to solve my 21-year-old's problems. That's the horse out of the barn. But my question to the panel is, what are we going to do? Everybody talks about children, early intervention, and that's great, and that's what fortunately ABA, Applied Behavioral Analysis, which seems to be the way to go, and that's the training that my son received, and he did very well with it. But he has no language, he can't read, he can't write. What's going to happen to these adults? Well, and that's the problem where I'm at now. And who's going to take care of this child when I'm dead?
Absolutely. Tim, and I appreciate the call. I appreciate your passion and your frustration as well. And what I hear certainly from you, Craig, and from you, Michelle, which is, you know, as Tim says, what is causing all this? I mean, the answer is we're looking into it, but we don't know the specific causes of autism.
Yeah, getting back to the cause.
You see the risk factors.
Sure. And it is frustrating for parents because it seems like, you know, we really haven't gone so far in terms of understanding causes in sort of the 2 decades that Tim and his family have been living with autism. And as far as, you know, finite messages, that's true. Right. But there's been a tremendous amount of progress made. I mean, we know while there wasn't, unfortunately, a slam dunk single gene that explained a lot of autism, there is a list of a large number of candidate genes that probably do cause autism, but they're present in only small fractions. So it's this idea that there's these multiple different causal pathways, and unfortunately, autism is a complicated disease from this kind of etiologic perspective. It just is the way it's playing out, and I know it's frustrating, but we are making progress bit by bit.
Yeah, well, and Amy, just as someone that works with parents, and I'm sure you've heard Tim's frustration.
We often...
And worry, obviously.
Certainly. We often get calls from parents whose biggest concern is what will happen to their child when they're no longer able to care for them. So that's certainly on the forefront of many parents' minds. In terms of Autism New Jersey's advocacy efforts, we are working with the state legislature to hopefully improve the services and availability of supports for the aging population of individuals with autism.
Well, Tim, I hope that helps. Michelle, you want to add anything?
Well, there's the issue with parents remaining in the dark about what causes this is any time one doesn't have information, that's going to create a lot of fear and concern, and those thoughts are justifiable. I think that's what's so difficult about this. And if you look at the history of looking at different body parts, we've been able to, surgeons have gotten inside the body for years. They would give someone a shot of whiskey and take out their appendix. And unfortunately, the brain, we've only been able to look at that through imaging studies for about 30 years. So it's still, the brain is a big mystery. And I think that contributes to the difficulty in identifying what this is.
Craig, you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to get to Tim's point about services and outcomes and understanding the trajectory of outcomes for adolescents and adults with autism. And it's true that there's still a big knowledge gap there. I think, you know, since it's been about 10 years since we've understood that the prevalence of autism is much higher, we've come to realize that this means that there are going to be a larger number of adolescents and adults. And this topic is one that's of great interest to us at the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute, and we hope to make this an area of focus of emphasis for research in the future, for understanding what these trajectories are and what best predicts better outcomes and what services are really going to make the most impact for adolescents and adults living with autism.
Because you see this as a public health issue.
Absolutely.
Beyond, involving individuals, but something of concern to the whole country. Tim, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Gary from, looks like Malvern, to join our conversation. And Gary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I'm a high-function autistic with Asperger's, and I'm going on to 68 years of age. So there are adults out there. But I need to emphasize I'm high function.
I hear you.
So I think that distinction needs to be made, because what I'm hearing is a tone that, oh my God, these poor people, and there's definitely a problem with low function, and that should be looked at. But I can tell you that my life has been hell not knowing, and I've only been diagnosed within the last decade.
Wow.
So I went through hell not knowing what was wrong with me. And now that I know, I realize that I have been able to compensate, just like a person with a left-handed person in a right-handed world, or a little person in a world where everybody's 5 foot. I've also realized that my brain has actually improved. I say this because for 2 reasons. One is, It's not hopeless, especially for high function. You can make a life. I married and I had a career in computers, by the way.
Interesting.
But more importantly, I want to point out that it's this increasing. I have a tough time speaking.
Gary.
This increase, it looks like the world's coming to an end because the numbers are getting higher and higher. And I believe that it's because they're only now focusing on autism. And we didn't even have a definition of Asperger's until the 1990s.
Well, you know, Gary, you actually said in a much more articulate way than I did, and I was trying to get at this notion of understanding the broad-based spectrum of behaviors. As you said, you're a high-functioning person, probably with Asperger's. Michelle Rowe, I don't want Gary or anyone else to go away from this conversation, you know, wringing their hands and thinking the world is coming to an end or the sky is falling.
Yeah, it's like I was saying about the perceptions of what we call disabilities. There are specific, we all have difficulties, no matter how functioning or low functioning we are. We all have difficulties, all that we may not have a diagnosis, but we have difficulties in certain areas. So at what point does that difficulty significantly impair with the quality of your life? And for people like you, Gary, clearly navigating this complex world, there have been some difficulties, but you have been very able to navigate it, not without pain, but of course everyone has pain in certain aspects of their life and we all struggle, but you've been able to successfully navigate it and live a quality life. And that's sort of been the mission with the Kinney Center, is to increase the likelihood of a quality life, because we believe that every person with autism has potential to live their best life, and clearly you have done that successfully at 68 years old. Those are the kinds of stories that I think more people need to hear.
Absolutely, Gary. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Amy, you want to add anything to that?
I would agree with everything that Michelle said. We have been hearing from more adults that more recently received a diagnosis, oftentimes very much later in life, and we've heard a lot about the struggles that they were involved in over the years, oftentimes in school settings where there weren't appropriate interventions for them. And again, with increased awareness, we're hoping that more and more people will learn about autism and how they can appropriately intervene in their own lives.
But what's interesting, what Gary said, you know, once he was given a diagnosis, it helped to explain the world to him, or him to the world.
Absolutely.
And Marty, could I just make another comment?
Sure.
I think it's very helpful for others, for younger people who are entering their adult years or middle-aged, to hear stories from Gary, because there are many, many individuals who feel isolated out there with diagnoses of high-functioning autism or Asperger's who need the support and help and guidance of others who have gone through these things.
And Gary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. We're going to take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Craig, I know you want to add something, but the clock is telling me we have to take a short break. We are talking about autism and autism-related disorders, a new estimate from the Centers for Disease Control. Michelle Rowe joining us by telephone, Executive Director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support, also Professor of Health Services at St. Joseph's University. Here with us in our Philadelphia studios is Amy Golden, and she's a board-certified behavioral analyst and the parent services coordinator at Autism New Jersey. And our third guest is Craig Neuschafer. He's a professor, chairman of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at Drexel University, and the new director of the new AJ Drexel Autism Institute. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, ChesterCountyHospital.org.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, Art After Five presents a celebration of Italian culture with Descanto, a group of Italian conservatory-trained musicians who reinterpret traditional Southern Italian songs through contemporary and traditional instrumentation, beginning at 5:45. More details are available at philipmuseum.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. If you could take a pill to forget the emotion around a bad relationship or how witnessing war made you feel, would you take that pill? Also, a father and son's journey back to baseball after almost giving up on the game in the wake of the steroid scandal. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
First Trust Bank supports WHYY, and First Trust supports Philadelphia's business community. Whether you need a loan, a line of credit, real estate financing, or cash management services, First Trust is here, ready to help. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about a new estimate from the Centers for Disease Control finding that 1 in 88 children in the U.S. has autism or a related disorder. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Craig, did you want to say something to Gary, who had called us right before the break?
Oh, I just had a comment about the trends, the prevalence trends. I think, you know, over a long span of time, going back 20 or 30 years, we definitely have seen increases in prevalence coming from both the higher functioning end and also the lower functioning end. We've become better able at recognizing autism in individuals who are cognitively impaired, and from the middle, from sort of the classic autism disorder diagnoses. Interestingly, just with respect to the new CDC numbers, from 2006 to 2008, for the states where they could classify into Asperger's, PDD, NOS, and autistic disorder, of which not all could,
yeah,
increases were consistent across the board
in those categories. Tell us a little bit about a study that's going on at Drexel, the early study, just to put our conversation into a context, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Sure. Thanks, Marty. So the early study is a study focused on understanding potential autism risk factors, and especially those that maybe could be avoidable. What we do in early is we find mothers who already have a child with autism, and we recruit them into the study as close as possible to the beginning of a new pregnancy. And then we follow that pregnancy very closely, and we take all kinds of information from the mom on lifestyle factors. We collect biological samples. When the baby's born, we collect samples at the hospital, and we follow that baby forward until age 3. The latest data suggests that siblings of individuals with autism have close to a 20% chance of landing somewhere on the autism spectrum. So it's an enriched risk, a high-risk group. So what we hope to do is, by studying this group that's at higher risk, has this genetic susceptibility, we'll be able to determine what environmental factors are working with genetic susceptibility and causing autism. Big study going on for many more years.
Many more, yeah. Until you get some kind of conclusive results.
Right.
Let me get, looks like Dr. Corin from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
I've been studying this issue for quite a few years now, and I've been writing and lecturing on it. I think the 800-pound gorilla that hasn't been mentioned is vaccinations. You know, are vaccinations the cause or contributing factor to autism? And I know a number of studies have been done in Denmark and with the CDC, that at the time they said conclusively proved that vaccines don't cause autism or mercury is not involved in it. And these studies have been disproven. It turns out they were junk science. They were very terribly flawed. One of the authors has been indicted for fraud. Another one, others have admitted that the research was sort of manipulated. And we now find something very interesting, and we have to go back to epidemiology.
Well, you know what, Dr.
By the way, even Dr. Andrew Wakefield, the British gastroenterologist,
right,
his studies have been reviewed, and they found out that one of his co-authors has been exonerated. There was no fraud or anything like that in that study, which indicated that parents repeatedly said their child was normal, then was vaccinated, and then was not normal anymore. And we hear this over and over again.
For example, let me take your comment, only because we have a lot of callers here, and certainly the question about vaccines and autism has been around for some time now. And I do want, and I appreciate the comment. And let me give you, Craig, a chance to take a crack at that first, and then Michelle. Go ahead, Craig.
Well, first, I appreciate Dr. Korn's views. I think his characterization of the quality of the body of evidence that's been done. Investigating the association between the correlation between vaccination and autism is not correct. I think of the nearly 20 studies that have been done, the majority of them are fairly meritorious. There's no such thing as a perfect epidemiologic study. Believe me, I live with that every day as an epidemiologist.
Right.
But I think the evidence base is very conclusive in indicating that vaccination, whether it's thimerosal, whether it's the MMR vaccine specifically, is not driving this trend in prevalence. The much harder question is, could there be a small group that has some susceptibility to some kind of immune challenge? Maybe it's vaccine, maybe it's a flu-like illness at an early age. That has not been disproven yet, but I think if that small subgroup exists, it's very small, and it's not driving this prevalence trend that we see.
Michelle, you want to add to that?
I would agree with that, that there are – you can't rule out that there aren't individual cases that have had these sorts of issues happen, but the large-scale studies support that the vaccines are safe.
Let me get – looks like Anne from Mount Airy to join our conversation. And Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask the panel whether any researchers have been looking at the method of birth, and along with that, gestational age before 42 weeks. It seems that this trend has been co-occurring with an increase in the trend in C-sections, especially non-medically indicated C-sections, and there's a high surgical infection rate just as background. So I was wondering whether anybody's been able to rule that out.
Well, I guess I'm back to you, Craig.
Sure. So there has been some investigations of gestational age, usually done in concert with the work on low birth weight, and it's very hard to unpack those factors. So I think that association does exist. Trying to figure out why and what's driving it is still an open question. With respect to mode of delivery, interesting question, one that I believe is under investigation in some of the larger epidemiologic studies that are underway right now. If we look back historically to some of the studies that have been published that have looked at this, the evidence has been equivocal. Some studies have shown an effect, others have not. But I think the larger, more modern epidemiologic studies that are now underway will be looking at those factors.
Amy, let me go back to you, and you talked a bit about some of the work you do as a behavioral analyst, the idea of working with people with either autism or some degree of autism spectrum disorder. In terms of the actual activities, I'm curious about what children are asked to do, or even what adults are asked to do in terms of this behavioral approach?
Sure. The behavioral approach is effective in teaching new skills and also reducing challenging behaviors. So it's an effective strategy to teach a variety of skills across many domains. So if we have a child that is newly diagnosed and we're starting programming for that child, we may begin with working on some communication skills like requesting desired objects or activities. We'll also work on imitation because that's a foundation for a lot of future skills. But applied behavior analysis is also effective for teaching skills that are important later in life, such as daily living skills, chores, opportunities for employment, and so it is a broad-based intervention.
Michelle, even picking up on that and going to you, I'm wondering if we're talking about people who may not be, who may feel socially awkward or have some interactional problems, is it important to push them into social activities and team sports and plays and things like that?
Well, there's things that can be done in terms of teaching them before they get forced into team sports. Mm-hmm. Social skills program gives them ideas about how to interact appropriately. So what comes naturally to so-called neurotypical mm-hmm. individuals or kids who do not have autism, kids with autism can be coached on what the appropriate things to say. There's a lot of slang that we use as a society. So when someone says, hey, do you want to go grab lunch? A kid with autism may say, I already had lunch. And when, in fact, the other child is saying, no, I mean, do you want to spend some time with me? So it's hard to read those social nuances. And with coaching through social skills, those kids with autism can learn what the appropriate behaviors would be and can increase the chance that they'll interact mm-hmm. with other kids and develop friendships.
You know, as we're talking, I'm thinking about Temple Grandin, who I've interviewed several times, and she has autism or Asperger's, and I think of all of her contributions, in the world of science, but also the books that she has written and her ability to explain, how she literally sees the world, how she sees language. And to me, she's such a shining example of what someone with this diagnosis can do with their life, Michelle.
And it shows how intelligent and adaptive these people are, too. I know John Elder Robison is another person who goes around and discusses how helping children and young adults to learn how to navigate this world that's very complex.
Do you want to add to that, Amy, just from your experience working with people?
I would agree with Michelle's comments.
Okay, fair enough. Let me get to Georgia from Mays Landing to join us on Radio Times. Georgia, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm in the process of becoming a first-time grandmom. My daughter is perfectly healthy, but she's had at least 19 ultrasounds where they keep comparing size of femur to size of head to size of abdomen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me that these days we use this ultrasound as a entertainment value, so that there's an ongoing onslaught of pictures of this poor baby in utero. I've looked a little bit online. It worries me. What are the effects of these sound waves on the baby's brain at points of development during the different stages of growth for this child?
And Georgia, just a quick question. Why 19? Do you know?
There is no real reason, but every time that she's had it, they say, we'll see you in 3 weeks, we'll see you in 3 weeks. She lives outside New York City. She tells me that's the way they do it up there.
Well,
and there are even places open where you can go and have a 3D sonogram done several times during your pregnancy and pay, I think it's $80, so that you can then add these pictures to the baby's book in an outside functioning area.
Well,
I don't understand why you would just onslaught this developing fetus with sound waves in this manner.
Well, Georgia, let me put your comment to Craig, who's sitting here.
Yeah, Georgia, it's an interesting question. I want to make two comments. The first is I'm not an expert in the effects of sound on the developing brain. I don't know of any a priori theory that would put us at a special alarm about this, but I do know that there have been some neurobiologists who have written, have looked at some animal models, and there could be some potential concerns. So I think this is another factor that some of these modern era studies are going to be able to examine. The larger point I want to make is there's a temptation when we think about risk factors to focus on things that are becoming more common over time, like ultrasounds, because the prevalence is going up. And while, epidemiologists look for that correlation, I think it's important that we not telescope our thinking that we only need to look at things that are going up in time. There was some concern a few years back about folic acid, about fortification of foods with folic acid. So that means that the exposure to folic acid has been going up over time. And this was done as a public health measure because folic acid obviously prevents neurotube defects. So folic acid exposure going up over time, could that be correlated with autism? Well, it turns out the first individual level studies have been done, and they show that prenatal vitamin supplementation, which includes folic acid, actually reduces autism risk. Now, that study has to be replicated, but I worry a lot that people focus on things that are just going up over time, and we shouldn't only be looking for those factors. We need to think more broadly about what could be possible causal risk factors.
And Michelle, you're a biopsychologist. I'd be curious what you have to say.
I don't know much about the impact of that on the brain, on the developing brain.
Well, we'll leave it. Georgia, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what it looks like Linda from University City has to say. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I hope you can hear me. My phone's being a little wonky.
Well, so far so good. Go ahead, Linda.
Okay, good. So I have a younger brother who my whole family and extended family strongly suspect has Asperger syndrome. And it's been really difficult to try to sort of get him functioning in the world. He's never had a job. He was at home with my parents. He pretty much plays video games all day long and whatnot. But when we approach him about, sort of becoming responsible and, taking control of his life, he just shuts down.
Mm.
And, my parents are older and he's the youngest, so we really want to get my parents into their retirement and relaxation. But I don't know what resources are there to help him, number one, recognize that he does have this condition, it's okay, and we can make things better. He can get a job. He can, support himself and do these things that he wants to do, but he just doesn't get it. Like, he doesn't listen to us when we give him suggestions of how to find a job or market himself. And
sure.
He, I don't know.
Sure.
He doesn't get it.
Well, you know what, Linda, I'm glad you called. And let me first toss that to Michelle Rowe, but I'd like to hear what Amy Golden has to say. And Michelle, what do you think?
Well, first of all, what state is he living in?
Is he in Philadelphia, Linda?
He's in New York City right now. However, you know, our parents are strongly considering leaving the country for their retirement, so we may bring him to
down
Philadelphia.
To
but the problem is, again, with that, he thinks that he can stay in New York in his own apartment by himself, but he has no job. He has no, you know, there have been incidents where we fear for leaving him by himself.
Indeed. Well, you know what, Linda, only because I'm looking at the clock here, I want to give Michelle and Amy a chance to at least give you some things to think about. Michelle?
Well, I would suggest there's some employers that are very good about doing this. I know Home Depot, Wawa, there are companies that hire individuals with autism and are very happy to have them work with them. Also, you may want to check into some of the local services that there may be some aspects of working on developing a plan for where he's going to live simply by contacting some of the wherever he's living in that area. You should contact the services there.
Yeah, Amy, anything you want to add to that? I guess in terms of adult services here.
Yeah, right. In terms of your particular situation, I think sometimes it's helpful to also get outside perspectives from professionals that have experience working with adults who may be on the spectrum. At Autism New Jersey, we have referral lists of diagnosticians and psychologists that have experience with adults. So if New Jersey is one of the areas that you may be considering moving to, or if you can access those resources, I would encourage you to call us.
Linda, thanks for the call. We're just about out of time. Craig, any final thoughts for our listeners?
No, Marty. It's been a really interesting range of conversations.
Indeed.
We've covered a number of important topics related to this new report.
Indeed we have, and that's Craig Neuschafer. He's professor chairman of the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics at Drexel University, the director of the A.J. Drexel Autism Institute. And, Craig, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're welcome. Amy Golden is a board-certified behavioral analyst and the parent services coordinator at Autism New Jersey. Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Michelle Rowe, who joined us by telephone, executive director of the Kinney Center for Autism Education and Support, also a professor of health services at St. Joseph's University. And Michelle, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for including me.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.